This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm here with Carrie Kasem. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, Alan.
I am just troubled by that intro when they said we're pre-recorded. Where did that come from? It begs the question, do I get to sue KABC for misrepresentation? Are you pre-recorded, Carrie?
I'm not. I'm live. I'm sitting here in the studio. Were we supposed to be pre-recorded this weekend?
No, we are here. I am not in the studio. I'm in my home, and this definitely is not pre-recorded because I will be in my home for a little while now. As I told you before the show, unfortunately, we had some disturbing news yesterday that my 7-year-old son tested positive for coronavirus. And we are waiting results. My daughter had her test the same time because they were going to camp and they needed to have a test. And I don't understand, Carrie, what they were thinking when they made these kids get tested. The camp doesn't start for 10 days, and apparently even if they're negative, in 10 days they could be positive. But
sure.
In our case, he was positive, and they lost the results for my daughter, so we don't know. And we've both been tested, my wife and I, and we're waiting. So this is a crazy time here at the Gervie House because we're trying to keep our distance. The doctor said it's most likely that we all have it. I haven't been feeling great. I'm not Chris Cuomo. I'm not going to be in my basement talking to you about the symptoms I'm having, but it is a difficult situation when you get one person in your family, your little son, who's positive, and now we're waiting for the rest. So that's my story. That is live. That was not pre-recorded.
No, it's not. You called me and you said, hey, this is what's going on. We're waiting on the tests. And I asked you if you were going to do the show, and you said absolutely. So here we are, not pre-recorded. We are live. And, you're now the sixth family that I know that has come down with it. And some people in families, one person got it, the other four or five didn't. Another one where everybody got it, mom, three kids, and grandma. Everybody so far, I don't know anybody personally who has passed from coronavirus.
I would prefer we not talk about that aspect of it. I think what's troubling, though, is the predicament that we're in right now because we don't know the results of the other people.
Right.
And so when we do get the results, which is supposed to be on Tuesday, if, in fact, we're all positive, then, it's a party, I guess, here at the Gervie House. And if some of us are negative and some of us are positive, that's going to be a tough situation. In the meantime, even if any of us test negative when we get the results from the others, if they ever find Harper's results, we're probably going to have to get tested again because we're living with someone who we know has tested positive, and the doctor said that there are no false positives. I don't know if we want to believe that or not, but if there are no false positives, thankfully, there are no symptoms. I'm the only one who has symptoms, but that's just because I'm tired, exhausted. I don't know if my fever is just, it's a very slight, it's just because I'm hot. I am hot. I look pretty good.
Yeah, you're hot. You're hot, I'm sure. I'm sure.
You can see me on FaceTime.
I can see you, yeah.
Yeah, so I look good. But other than that, I'm not sure that our reopening is going really well. When I spoke to our test site, and again, we were only getting tested because of the kids had to go to camp, which apparently they're not going to be doing anymore, and I'm not going into the office, but the guy there told me, the doctor there actually said, they have been flooded with positive tests. So people out there who are listening, if you think that there aren't going to be a lot of positive tests over the last 3 days, he said that he couldn't believe, the doctor couldn't believe how many tests were positive. There's a lot of asymptomatic people out there passing this around.
They said, I mean, this was confirmed by the CDC that asymptomatic people do not pass it around. They said that. That was from CDC, not anyone else. That was said about a week and a half ago.
I didn't hear that.
Yes, yeah, the CDC actually came out with that. They also came out with on that same day that it doesn't live on surfaces for very long after we were told it could live on surfaces for weeks. So they did change. They did flip-flop on those two. Maybe they flip-flop back, Alan, but that was in about a week and a half ago. They did say that.
The irony is, Carrie, and maybe that's true. I don't know. I think there's so much information we just don't know.
Right.
We have been very vigilant about wearing masks. I've worn masks every time I leave the house, and I don't leave the house very often. My kids have been in the house. So
you carry spray bottles.
Careful,
yeah, you carry spray.
We don't know.
You carry spray bottles. You carry bleach. I honestly, of all of the people I know and all my friends, you were the most diligent. So who knows?
You saw when I came into the studio, and I haven't come in often. I've come in a couple times. I stayed my distance. I wouldn't let you hold the door open, and you were so kind to do that. I said, I can open the door myself. Thank you. I went into my little corner by my mic. I had this Lysol spray. I was spraying everyone. I think I sprayed it in my own face. So you just don't know. So everyone out there, you got to be careful and hope for the best, because there is a degree of risk regardless of how you are conducting yourself. But that gets me to the point. I think it is best. And I know, Carrie, you might disagree with me, but I'm all for closing down everything.
Yeah, that's insane.
I know you're not. And I think that if people don't understand the principle that unless we get a handle on this, their businesses are not going to be open in the long term. So you either take the loss in the short term, and then in the long term, you're going to be okay, or you keep fighting to have everything open, and you'll never get people to come to your businesses because it's going to be too rampant.
Well, why?
Go ahead, Carrie.
Right. I mean, and I hear you. I'm looking at the fact that it's a 98.8% survivable virus for most of us, not for the elderly and not for the immune compromised. We look at the flu, almost the same thing. So we have not been able to stop the flu, right? So are we all going to just close down America because we've got a 98.8 survivable virus, bacteria, whatever they're calling it now? So I understand. I think, we'll see what happens with you guys. Every one of my friends who've had it are fine.
Carrie.
Yes.
If people share that, and I'm not saying that it's wrong. I mean, I don't agree with you.
Right.
But why are people so afraid to engage in life again if it's just like the flu?
Because it's the media, Alan. We do not see this. When 80,000 people died 2 years ago with the flu, you didn't have a countdown of deaths, right? We have a countdown of all the deaths on TV. They also show you, and I've seen this, news that's created to make it make fear-mongering news. You and I have both seen the media do that. So I feel like at this point, the media should be on trial for what they've done to this country. Not saying that the virus isn't real. I've never not said that. What I am saying is you don't have to be told there's a pandemic. If there's a pandemic, your neighbors are dead. There's people dead on the street. There are people dying everywhere. And that's not the case. That is not what happened. We have a very bad flu virus going on that's 98.8% survivable for most of us. I don't understand it.
Why am I so fearful at this moment as I speak to you? I don't feel like I have the flu, or my children, my 6 and 7 year old children, and my wife. I think that you can say that all you want, but there is an element. You can say the media has blown it out of proportion and they've created it.
Yeah.
But when you get it, when you test positive, there is a fear of the unknown. And that's really what we're facing here, whether people like it or not, whether they think the media is blowing it out of proportion. And maybe you're right with your statistics, but we have to look at the people here. And certain people, if they have arrogance, if they have selfishness, if they have stupidity, there are people who will suffer from this and may not die, but it's a hell of a ride for a lot of people, and I don't know that we want to be responsible. I certainly don't. I will not leave my house with the fear of infecting someone else that may not take it as well as hopefully me or my family.
Right.
I will not do that to others.
Well, I think that's great. Why haven't we done that with the flu every year? I see tens of thousands of elderly die every year when I'm helping families trying to get visitation to see their family members. Mom or dad's locked away, isolated in an institution or a nursing home or a hospital or a residential home. And you know, the kids can't get in to see them. And I've had many cases where they haven't seen mom or dad for a year, 2 year, 3 year, and then the flu season hits and mom and dad die. And we don't see anybody caring to stay home. We don't see anybody wearing masks or gloves or saying, let's take care of our elderly. But now that the media has put the fear of God into everybody, now we care? Why didn't we care the last 10 years of when the elderly were hit so hard? I think it's a good thing. I think if you're sick, you stay home. What you're doing is correct. I would never argue with you. What you're doing is absolutely right. If you are sick, your family is sick, stay home. That simple. Don't make everybody else suffer. You should look, if you're out and you're sick, that's when you should get in trouble. That's when you should say, hey, you're infecting other people. You're going to make people sick. That's common sense. You don't make healthy people wear masks where they're breathing in their own CO2. You don't make healthy people destroy their businesses because a few people, you know, are terrified of this virus. Let's just be responsible. If you're sick, stay home. Period.
I don't know you're representing the entire public when you say a few people are terrified of this virus. You have to remember the asymptomatic issue here, where no one in my family was symptomatic or has been symptomatic. And the fact of the matter is, if they can pass it on, whether wearing a mask or not, it still is a risk to people who could suffer greatly. Unfortunately, we have to go on with the show. If people have any comments, if people side with Carrie, feel free to call in at 800-222-5222.
There were calls.
800. What?
There were calls. We had some calls, but you and I were arguing. I can't wait to see how you and your family do in a week, in 2 weeks, and we'll talk about it again.
Forget about my family. It's not important here. The general public is much more important. I'll deal with my family here. 800-222-5222. If you agree with Alan, feel free to tell us that. If you agree with Carrie, we'll do a little bit of a survey here. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to devote the whole show because we've got some wonderful guests here. There are other issues that are going on. One of them recently in California has to do with affirmative action, where the ACA, which is the Assembly Constitutional Amendment number 5, it will be on the ballot in November to determine whether or not state agencies and universities can resume affirmative action programs. This is probably as a result of the protests and things that have gone on. We have two very educated and very well-spoken guests to debate this. Ward Connerly will be with us. He's a former University of California regent, and he had a lot to do with Prop 209, which put a kibosh on the affirmative action. And he's going to be talking with Audrey Dow, who's senior vice president for the campaign for college opportunity. And Carrie is showing me how many calls we're getting. We're lighting
the,
up.
The board's lit up. 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. People want to talk about this, Alan.
Okay, if we can keep on hold, let's see what we can do about taking some calls. But we need to get Ward and Audrey to talk about this latest development in California. Later in the show, we'll have James Bostwick, who is the founder of Bostwick Computerson, very well-known attorney who wrote a book called Acts of Omissions, and the paperback has just come out on June 9th. So we'll talk to him about his book, Acts and Omissions. Thanks for calling in. Everyone is calling.
The board is lit up.
I want to take these calls so badly.
We're going to do it quickly when we come back.
You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 ABC.
Back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. We don't need money. We got the power of love going right here on Gervie's Law. I can't believe it. In the 10 minutes that we spoke, Carrie and I, expressing some opinions and talking about my personal story of having my 7-year-old son testing positive and having the rest of the family waiting anxiously to hear what happens, and the whole board lights up. Carrie? Yep.
Okay, so we're going to go to Pete in Orange. Pete, who do you agree with, Carrie or Alan?
Oh, it's Carrie all the way. It's Dr. B. How are you?
Oh, hi, Dr. B. Thanks for calling. This is my doctor. This is literally my doctor calling in, and he agrees.
All right, we need to get some objective people on. Okay, so let's go to the next person.
Okay, so Susan in Buena.
Oh, listen, Carrie is so right. Alan, you are wrong. You're barely listening to her. Point.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Susan. We're going to go to Martin. Martin, who do you agree with, Carrie or Alan?
I agree with Alan. If we had done nothing, the coronavirus would have been far worse than any other flu we had ever seen. So I completely disagree with Carrie.
Okay, thanks, Alan. I'm sorry. Thanks, Martin. And I don't agree with Alan. Mitchell, we've got Mitchell on the line. Mitchell, who do you agree with? Mitchell, turn your radio down. Oh, he went off. Oh, okay. Well, that's it. They're still calling in, but we need to get in.
Check in. I want to introduce now Ward Connerly and Audrey Dow.
Ward
Connerly is not on yet.
Nope, she hasn't. She doesn't. He went off. She's calling him again. So I think
is Audrey on?
No, we have. They're being called right now. But that was. I think you got one to my five.
Right.
I win.
Well, you win when you tell your friends to call in.
Okay, hold on. I had called my one.
Named Martin, who happens to have the same name as my brother, Martin Gervey. That was not my brother. I had never heard that voice before. So my one vote was legitimate. How do you prove that your five votes
were legitimate?
Hold on a
second. I didn't have anybody call in. Dr. B.
He said it was. He told you it was your doctor.
Do you think I actually call my doctor and have his cell phone number? That was just amazing that he actually happened to listen to our show.
You know your doctors, you know everyone.
Okay, so we'll go with Susan agreed with me. I think the other four.
All right,
now we have Ward on. So we'll go to him instead of arguing.
Anyone else who wants to call in, if you are upset about the fact that Carrie prevailed 5-1, that this is nothing, that this whole coronavirus thing.
Hey, do not put words in my mouth.
If you feel differently, support Alan. I'm someone who, you know, who's suffering through something right now that I'm dealing with. So, you know, if you support me, fine. If not, I'm going to feel really good because everyone supports Carrie. Do we have Ward and Audrey on?
Yes, we have Ward on right now. Let me introduce
Ward and Audrey. Ward Connerly is former University of California regent. He's the founder, chairman of American Civil Rights Institute. That's a national nonprofit organization in opposition to racial and gender preferences. He was considered to be one of the main people behind California's Prop 209, which prohibited race and gender-based hiring, contracting, and state university admissions, otherwise known as affirmative action. He's the founder with his wife of Connerly and Associates. His autobiography is Creating Equal, My Fight Against Racial Preferences. Also on the line with us is Audrey Dow. She is the senior vice president for the Campaign for College Opportunity, which is an LA nonprofit that advocates for more expansive access to higher education. She launched the 1 million more college graduates by 2025 campaign. She has said that race matters. And we are going to talk now about ACA 5, which is Assembly Constitutional Amendment number 5, which would repeal Prop 209. Ward, Audrey, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ward, let's start with you. You have a little history on this issue. Tell us what was behind Prop 209 and why you believe that this ballot, measure that we put on the ballot in November should not overturn Prop 209.
California is a very diverse state, probably the most diverse in our country. People come here from all around the globe, different languages, different cultures, different skin color, different, quote, races. In my view, and those of us who supported Prop 209, the only way that we can have a civil society is for the government to be neutral when it comes to matters of race and who gets hired and who gets to attend what college the government should remain neutral with regard to those matters when it, as far as race is concerned. And I believe that race and gender-based affirmative action has outlived its usefulness. It started in 1965, actually started before that, by an executive order from President, then-President John F. Kennedy. And that executive order in 1961 provided that the government would treat us all equally, quote, without regard to race and sex and so on. 4 years later, President Johnson altered that, and it became race with regard to race. I think that's wrong. I think we're headed for trouble if we don't embrace the without regard to philosophy.
Why do you think this is back on the ballot? Why do you think this is occurring now again?
Well, why don't we ask Audrey that? Because she, I think, is supporting this ballot measure. So let's hear from Audrey. Why is this in the forefront?
Well, thank you so much for welcoming me to the show. You know, the support for ACA 5 and the effort to ban, you know, or to overturn Proposition 209 is really about fighting discrimination, creating opportunity for all. You know, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Connerly that we are in this race-neutral society. You know, I think the reason why we are seeing people take to the streets to protest is because we are living in what is today the legacy of institutions and policies that have been designed to benefit white males in particular. And we have not overcome those systemic barriers. We have stark racial disparities in education, in contracting, in hiring, in housing. You name the space, there are stark racial disparities. And that is because we live in a system that is designed to maintain those disparities and those inequities.
So, Audrey, what about the president being black, like Obama? He was black.
Still is.
Yeah, was, is, his wife, his family, their black family. And the most powerful man in the world, that's what he became when he was the president of the United States. How does that factor in?
I think that the election of President Obama was the election of one person. The simple election of one person to becoming the president of the United States does not erase the policies and practices that are in place that are keeping out people of color, and in many instances, women. Proposition 209 is about both gender and about race. We have yet to elect a woman to be president of the United States. Discrimination is real. And I think generation is done with that, and I think that's why we have seen the day where this is going to be back on the ballot, and as polling indicates, I think it will pass.
Ward, I want to ask you that I know that you support equality, obviously. The goal seems to be the same. We're talking about a process. Why do you believe that affirmative action is not the way to reach that goal? Let's talk about the African-American population and how to get this equality.
I think that the best way for anyone, regardless of their, quote, race, is to get an education, at least get out of high school and go to a community college, but get yourself prepared to be a productive member of society. If you do that, then our society has an obligation to not discriminate against you. Now, I can understand Audrey's response that President Obama was just one man, but he was an important man. He was a symbol of not only his own abilities, whatever they are, but it's a symbol of our society's reaction to him. And I believe that it signified that we as a people in this country have reached the point where the institutional racism that she speaks of, the systemic racism, as they call it, that we were prepared to put that behind us. And we, in fact, did in 2008. and we reaffirmed that in 2012. And so we cannot endure, in my view, the use of race as the barometer for dividing our people and expect that at some point it's not going to back up on us. And I think that we've reached that point. The riots and protesting that we've seen in the streets is inexplicable to me. To suggest that it's a reaction to the racism, I don't know how you go in and take a television out of Target and say that is going to somehow assuage the racism that you claim existed in our society. That is
not a
barometer of it.
Good point, but I think Audrey might have a response to that. But unfortunately, we have to take a quick break. We're going to hear Audrey's response to that after the break. And the other question I want to ask both of you is, what other steps can be taken to ensure this equality and to have all races have an opportunity that don't necessarily involve affirmative action? You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, we are back. Carrie, are we back?
Now I
cool.
am. Thanks, Wayman.
I was looking for that red light. We are staring each other on FaceTime, and I didn't see the red light. Now I do. We're talking with Ward Connerly, former University of California regent, who had a lot to do with California Prop 209 way back when, and I'm sure will have a lot to do with the measure on the ballot in November, ACA 5, which would repeal Prop 209, and Audrey Dow, who's Senior Vice President for the Campaign for College Opportunity. Before the break, Ward had said that he wasn't impressed with the looting, taking TVs from Target, not a great expression of trying to make a point. Audrey, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that's completely taken out of context. I think that we all know the vast majority of individuals who are out there expressing their upset at the current, state of policing and racial inequity have been peaceful protesters. We know thousands of people have been out there peacefully protesting, and it has been a small group of individuals that have been causing damage or looting. So I don't think that that's an accurate portrayal. But what I will say is that, having Proposition 209 up before this generation, this is a new generation, 25 years later, and they keenly understand how the presence of Proposition 209 has tied the hands of policymakers and administrators from really addressing racial equity. The UC system, which Mr. Connerly was a part of, has for the last 25 years tried to employ race-neutral policies to improve the representation of underrepresented students, and it has not worked. They have been trying lots of different policies to get at better representation of Latino students, of Southeast Asian students, of Black students. They have been trying efforts to have more women in their faculty ranks. And nothing has been successful because we've been unable to consider race in admission, in hiring, in contracting. Nobody is saying that race should be the only factor we consider, but it should be a really important part of a process where it can be considered. Because to believe in this day and age in 2020 that race has no impact on your standing and as an individual, in the resources that you get in your school, in the way in which a person reads your resume and may see that you have an ethnic name, to think that racism and implicit bias don't exist is really just you're living in an alternate universe.
Ward, let me ask you this. With respect to what Audrey just said, if that's true and we are living in a different generation, and I'm sure you have comments about the last one during the Prop 209 debates way back when, is it a foregone conclusion that affirmative action programs will resume and that Prop 209 will be repealed?
No, and emphatically no. You know, there are certain values that are timeless. If we're going to put a time clock on whether every American, every Californian is entitled to equal treatment under the law, if there is a time clock on that, we may as well go back to the founding of this country and change the Constitution, change all of the laws that we've put in place to ensure equal treatment for every person, change the Civil Rights Act of 64, take it off the books, wipe it out, so that we can use the color of a person's skin to decide who gets to go to Berkeley, who gets to go to UCLA, who gets to go to the University of San Diego, Santa Barbara, and so on. Again, I think that the language of 209, which is that the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin, is as timeless as they get. And we need to embrace that. If we don't, if the government starts saying we're going to use race, but just a little bit, just a little bit, then we're going to screw up like you can't believe. We are too complex as a society. We're too naturally diverse. And people are not going to stand still for the government not only putting a finger on the scales, but putting their whole butt on the scales to deny people the opportunity to be treated equally.
All right. Audrey, we have one. Audrey, you're going to have your say. We have 1 minute left. We're giving you the last word. I don't think you agreed with Ward.
No, I think to say what Mr. Connerly's argument is missing is that we are currently discriminating by race and ethnicity and gender in many things that we're doing. To think that the Constitution was created so that all men could be created equal, women were left out of that equation. Black people weren't even considered a whole person when the Constitution was written. We are in an era still living this legacy of separate and unequal, and where people of color are treated by our systems in a very real way, inequitably. The state is discriminating. And what the repeal of Proposition 209 will do is give our policymakers one additional tool to finally address that built-in discrimination that exists today by our
Well, state. We appreciate both sentiments, Audrey and Ward. Audrey Dow and Ward Connerly, we want to thank you for being with us today on Gervie's Law. We may have to have you back closer to November to renew this debate because it really is an important one. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to welcome James Bostwick as our guest here on Gervie's Law. You don't want to miss that. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Nothing I can see but you when you
dance. Yeah, we're dancing right now on Gervie's Law. Our next guest is Jim Bostwick. He's founder of Bostwick and Peterson Law Firm up in San Francisco, who does complex medical malpractice, wrongful death claims, and very complex personal injury claims. He's the former president of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, and he has had record-breaking jury verdicts and settlements listed as one of the best lawyers in America. His book is called Acts of Omission, and it is nominated for the prestigious Harper Lee Prize for Legal Fiction. It was released in paperback just a couple weeks ago, and it is available all over. I believe the hardcover sold out. So many great reviews for Acts of Omission. One reviewer said, I was hooked from the first page. I read to the last and still wanted more when it was over. Acts of Omission draws you into the daily life of a trial lawyer
catapults you into the courtroom and has you on the edge of your seat, anxiously waiting to hear what unfolds next. I am not a lawyer, but now I want to be. You think 45 years old is too late? Thank you for talking to your readers and then taking them along this legal thriller. Jim Bostwick, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, I'm sure you would be after that introduction. Anyone would be happy.
Oh, my gosh. Alan. Nope. Alan and his introductions.
No kidding. That's a great one. That's a great introduction.
Tell us about the genesis of the book. I mean, you've gotten such great reviews, but at the same time, people don't realize your illustrious career going back to, suing probably the most famous trial lawyer in America at the time, Melvin Belli, and how the whole genesis started for this book.
Well, actually, I love reading, and I love reading legal thrillers and things like that, but I was a little bit, put off by the fact that all of them are about criminal law. And, that's, of course, a lot of fun, and I enjoy reading about that, and it's a very important part of our society. You know, there's a whole great unwashed bunch of civil law lawyers out there that are doing lots of stuff, and nobody writes about them unless they're making jokes about ambulance chasers or something, stereotypes like that. And I really wanted to write a book. And the other thing that always bothered me about legal thrillers is they're not realistic. They write about things that lawyers read, and they say, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in court. That doesn't happen in our life.
Like what? Like what? Because I love books. I love legal thrillers. I love all that stuff. What when I'm reading or when I'm watching a movie, what would be the one or the number one thing to look out for? That's a lie.
Well, nothing ever happens in 2 or 3 minutes.
Yes,
and of course, when you're watching a movie, it has to all be condensed a lifetime into 2 hours. So things like that have to happen. And by the way, we're working on a movie on the book, so that's in the works.
Oh, congrats!
That's writing it right.
Yeah, that's something to look forward to.
That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, when you're reading a book, it somebody gives an opening statement, and the opening statement is about one paragraph long, and that's not how we do it. That's not how you tell a jury about a complicated case. It makes for fast reading, and it makes it exciting, but it's not reality. And I wanted to do it something fun, something with romance and betrayal and all kinds of, the danger and the kinds of things that are fun in novels, but also was realistic, something authentic, something that is really how lawyers think. It's what motivates them. It's what risks they take and things like that.
You know, when you think about David versus Goliath type of thing, it sounds like something that you're harping back on in your career. You started with well-known attorney Bruce Walkup at his firm, and you learned from a master. When you looked at this book, did you have some disdain for some of the older, arrogant type attorneys that we all deal with? I hope I'm not one of them, but I know as a younger attorney, and especially now, I still look at some of these arrogant old attorneys, and I just want to put them in their place if I can. Was that some of the motivation here?
Well, no, not really, because I was lucky. Like you said, I was with Bruce Walkup, and he was one of my main mentors, and he was a fabulous lawyer, and maybe one of the top 3 or 4 in the country, founded the Inner Circle and had the first $1 million verdict in the country. He was an amazing guy. And he wasn't arrogant. The ones that are arrogant, everybody would like to take them down a bit. And there are guys like that out there. Right? And like in any field of endeavor, the ones that get near the top can be pretty impressed with themselves. Most of them, however, are just really, those guys are just out there doing everything they can for their clients and taking huge risks and innovating. You mentioned Belli. Belli was a character. He was an amazing character. He was infamous and famous, but he also was a great innovator. And that's what he brought to the law. And in his day, he was an extraordinary person who who gave us a lot that we wouldn't have had without his thinking. So now I was less interested in taking them down and more interested in showing people what we do.
And I want to follow up on that, what you do. When you look back, and now I'm not going to say you're an older attorney, but you've got some experience behind you, some huge settlements and huge wins. What would you recommend to the young attorney? I mean, in the book, the young attorney's kind of down on his luck, had a divorce and some issues at home, issues at work. What is your recommendation to young attorneys now, looking back and using your career as kind of a shining light?
Well, I think the main thing that I would say to them is that it can be very discouraging. It's very rare in this business that everything goes just like you think it's going to go. You just got to keep trying. You just got to keep going. And as a young lawyer, be certainly you pick your cases very, very carefully. The other thing I would say to young lawyers is that a lot of lawyers think that they have to go out there and be contentious. They have to fight with everybody. You know, that the only way to get ahead is to argue with everybody and disagree with everybody. That is not the way to get ahead. The way to get ahead is to make friends of the folks on the other side. They're not your enemies. You have to work with them and recognize that they have a job to do too, and work together to get at the truth, get at justice. And if you do that, eventually it's going to work out well. Of course, along the way you need some luck too, mostly you got to work your butt off. You got to spend a lot of hours.
Now, writing the book, did you take from real life experiences?
Oh yeah, almost everything. Not everything, of course, but almost everything in the book legally happened to me in either that case or in other cases over the years. I've had judges act just the way that judge did. I've had things happen to me with other lawyers just like that. And so most of it, yes. Some of it, of course, it's a novel. That's the fun thing. You can make stuff up, too.
Right.
And then suddenly the characters start doing things you never expected they would do. That's kind of fun, too.
I so appreciate your comments about what young attorneys should be concerned about. I find more often than not, you have a young attorney who's trying to make his or her name and fight just for the sake of fighting. And, you know, it becomes really frustrating. Someone who's looking to present their best case, to get the evidence, to do discovery, when you have someone on the other side who is not showing respect, who is not listening, who has preconceived ideas on how to run the case. And, you know, it's not so much that the other attorney is going to make your case or not, but it certainly helps in going to court on a case. I know that I've often think of, you know, a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge. But besides that, how have you been able to fashion such a long and successful career when you've had, as you said, a lot of obstacles? It's not that easy. And I think that's what's portrayed in the book, Acts of Omission.
Well, I would venture to say virtually every real successful lawyer out there has had all kinds of difficulties along the way. I mean, I'll bet you there's not a lawyer out there that has become wildly successful that had somewhere along the line didn't bet the farm on a case that they wondered whether they ever should have taken. Sometimes you just have to take risk, and you have to be prepared for that. Sometimes you have to put it all on the line, and it's not always going to work out. Nobody that's tried a lot of cases has won them all.
That's right.
That does not happen.
No, and the book is called Acts of Omissions, and people can get it now in paperback, right?
Yes, they can. It just came out in paperback, and it's really a beautiful rendition. It looks almost like a hardbound. It isn't just a little floppy paperback. It's a beautiful, well-published book. It looks very nice. And you can get it on Audible. You can get it on Kindle. You can get it. But I like to have them so I can read about it.
Me too. You know. Me too.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on your success.
Yeah, and the reviews are great. If anyone wants to look at Goodreads or any of the other websites with reviews, it's amazing to see such great reviews. We're going to look forward to seeing the movie made with the wonderful book. And Jim, we want to thank you. Jim Bostwick of Bostwick and Peterson, thanks for being with us on Gurvey's Law today.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a great day. And that's going to do it. Carrie, do you have some more calls? Can we keep this?
Okay, so for the next 2 minutes, we can see who wins. If anybody thinks that California should stay closed, then you're for Alan. If you think California should open up, you're for Carrie. You can call us at 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. Do we open California or do we keep it shut like Newsom wants to do?
Okay, well,
mask wearing.
It's a little bit conclusionary there, but anyway, we get the idea. You have 1 minute. I think we're going to take a break next week. We're going to wish everyone a happy 4th of July. I'm going to take care of my family here to see what goes on with us, because the next week to 10 days is going to be critical with my family. And Carrie looks shocked. What is shocked?
Oh, no. My gosh. I thought nothing is shocking.
Someone agreed with me?
No. We're waiting for calls because I just realized we have a delay. I didn't realize that, but I thought it was only 30. I think it's a minute, right, Wayman? Yeah. So I'm like, okay, I don't know. Maybe we'll make it. Maybe we'll make it and we'll see if we can get who wins this time. But so far it was me 5-1.
We'll pick it up in a couple of weeks. We're going to have Larry Elder on, who's going to talk about his new documentary, Uncle Tom. That's going to take place in a couple of weeks after the 4th of July holiday. We're wishing everyone a great American 4th of July holiday. And hopefully there'll be some coming together. As Rodney King said, can't we all just get along?
Feel better, Alan.
I'm going to feel as good as I can, and I'm really with my family. We're all going to hang in there. It's going to be great. Everyone have a great couple of weeks. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.